Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara. Ye sorvanta bhamunjantu satam. So this is our opportunity to reflect on the way it is, the Dhamma. It's the winter solstice has passed. Christmas is 2 days away. New Year, winter's retreat. All these are perceptions that arise in the present, and they have meaning to us. Like the winter solstice, it always means the days will get longer. Here in Northern Europe, it's very obvious, the shortening of the days and the lengthening. The seasons are very clearly defined. And to reflect on alms mendicancy, what is, this is something we can identify with, but it's important to reflect on how this tradition has survived on alms, on generous donations made by the lay community. So when we take the precepts, the bhikkhu ordination, the Siladhara ordination, we're now depending on the kindness of others. And this I found very important to keep remembering, because people tend to be so generous that it's easy to just take it for granted that we're spiritually evolving people who are worthy, thinking ourselves worthy of alms, and that people should give us food, shelter, robes, medicine for illness. But this leads to complacency, and one can't really claim to be a mendicant if one just assumes this, takes for granted. Now we have a new sala, beautiful new place for meetings and alms food donations and so forth. And this is the generosity of the lay community to make our lives livable and better, more comfortable in this time. And watch how we may form opinions about it. We can take it for granted that it's somebody built it for the Sangha, and we just take it for granted, or we can reflect. It's a place donated by lay people for the welfare of the Sangha. So then we develop a sense of gratitude. And gratitude is an important experience for us as alms mendicants, because we have so much to be grateful for. And I look at my own body and I think, this is an alms food body. 58 59 years next year of just living on alms food. So when you look at your body as an alms food body, then it's different than seeing it just as your body that's and taking it for granted, but also realize that one's body is a food body. We need food in order to survive. If the body doesn't get fed, then it starves and dies. So I encourage you to reflect on your own body as alms food rather than as, you know, whether it's young or old, male or female, or whatever way we might perceive ourselves. This is supported by generous donations by the lay people. So in this way, to develop a sense of that the body's no longer my personal possession. It's just, you know, it's my body, I can do what I want with it, but it's a body that has been allowed to live, practice meditation, develop the spiritual life in a way that is very unique, very wonderful in its quality. Gratitude and contentment. These are a foundation for insight into Dhamma, into enlightenment. A complaining mind, discontentment. And in there's always life in the that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think and feel is there's so much to complain about. So it's not that we don't feel have these emotions of complaining, but we can use them to see that they arise and cease, that this realm that we identify with as a self, as an ego, as a personal experience is really just the changing conditions of sankharas, food and shelter, something to wear, medicine for illness. And this is the heart of the samana life, the mendicant life. Here in the UK, we have been received incredible generosity from the lay community, and more than I ever expected. I didn't know what to expect when I first came to live in London. And in Thailand, it's easy to take Thailand for granted. It's a Buddhist country. 98% of the people identify with Theravada Buddhism. So wherever you go on Tudong, you go wandering through the countryside, into the forest and that. They can always depend on villagers or lay people to provide food, shelter if they can, and robes if they can. But here in Europe, one can expect that kind of, take it for granted, because it's a different society. It's based on materialism, on modern science, on psychology, on Judaism, on Christianity. different ways of looking at experience. So when we go into the new cellar, just think of it as a generous donation, a shelter, very beautiful, put together shelter for us to enjoy, to meditate in, to have our food, have our meal, our alms food meal. Like the meditation on the body is the first foundation of mindfulness. It's based on investigating. You know, what do people really know how to investigate their own bodies? They might look up anatomy books or physiology books from the library, trying to understand the body through charts and pictures and graphs. But the meditation on the body, what is it that can observe the body? Just ask yourself questions like, can the body observe itself? Can your right hand observe your left hand? And then you begin to realize that conscious awareness, mindfulness, awareness is what we use to investigate, to observe, to be the witness to the way the body is. Not how it should be or compare it. It's not about comparing it with ideal models of male, female physiques, but it's about the way it is. The body's like this. Sitting is like this. I feel the pressure of the seat on the sitting in this chair. My right hand on my left. I'm aware of it. Is the body aware of it? You know, when I never investigate the body, then I think, well, awareness is me, is mine, and it's consciousness, that if I'm conscious, then I can be aware of the body. But what we generally believe consciousness is seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, thinking, feeling. But the body we have, it's always here and now. Whatever posture, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, it's always, whether you're aware of it or unaware of it, whether it's young or old, male or female, we have this body to reflect upon. And that ability to reflect on the body is not the body, not a person, not like my personality. It's the ability to be just a witness with no name. The body's like this, sitting is like this. Then I can make it personal. Am I sitting properly? Can you get enlightened sitting in a chair? You know, these are questions that come up because sometimes the tradition is held so tightly that you think you have to sit in full lotus posture to really get enlightened. So we read books about posture, yoga, and how to use the body, how to keep it healthy, diet, right kind of food to consume. And we're quite interested in these things, in diet and in good health, that we take very personally. My diet, we become vegetarian or vegan or we form strong opinions about food. But then in this tradition, the reflection is alms food, which is not defined. It's whatever the lay people offer. So whether we like the food, or it's meat or fish, or it's vegan, vegetarian, whatever, it's still alms food. And then we personally might have strong views about meat and eating meat and fish. But that's also not that it's wrong. It's not wrong, but it is a view that we cling to. And the important thing is to observe this clinging, this grasping of views, perceptions, opinions, is the very cause of suffering, whether you're a purity culture person or strict vegetarian or a meat eater. Having views about vegetarians, vegans, or meat-eating monks and nuns is still views and opinions. The reflection is alms food, whatever the lay people provide, put into the alms bowl. So I found reflecting like this is very helpful, because one is personally brought up to have strong views and opinions about right and wrong, virtue and vice, what should and shouldn't be. We can cling to our identity as alms mendicants and feel superior to people who are not. And that's a view and opinion, you know, conceit that we can believe in and grasp. But it's not that we shouldn't, but we can use it to see the suffering we create by feeling ourselves better than someone else. In my own investigation, I've observed the tendency to be conceited over I'm a spiritually evolved person, or I'm a monk, a bhikkhu, and that I'm better than the ordinary lay people. It's not that I've never felt that kind of emotion or had that perception, but when you observe the grasping of that perception of being better than somebody else, it's not peaceful, it's not content, it's divisive, it's not a comfortable perception to grasp. So when you investigate like this, then you let go. You don't have to think of yourself in such a limited way as a bhikkhu, a siladhara, an anagarika, and on like that, and always see it as your identity. It is merely a convention to be used wisely. And in the West, we have this view that of equality. It's about we're all equal. And so that is a very liberal view in some ways. You know, it's better than thinking that the wealthy people or Christians or Buddhists are better than others. But no matter how righteous our views might be, there's still a form of suffering. The grasping of views, whatever, the righteous views, wrong views, seeing ourselves always with guilt and shame of things we've done or said in the past. And the witness is sati sampajanya, the ability to just observe, and not to try to get rid of these views, but to use the views that arise in our mind to see them with wisdom, that they arise and cease. They're just phenomena arising and ceasing, being born and dying. And that leads to samaditi, right view, which is not righteous view. It's seeing things as they are, rather than according to what the prejudice, the biases, the cultural conditioning, the class identities, gender identities that we tend to prefer or believe in. So equality, where are we all equal at this very moment? Is everyone here in the temple, where are we all equal at this very moment? Is a good question to ask yourself. And then physically, we're not equal. Whether you're male or female, they're not exactly equal. Whether you're black or white, they're not. Is black equal to white? You know, you can think in terms of phenomena as, you know, is it all just equal, or that's one way of just trying to be fair. But where is it? Can equality, can the earth, water, fire, and air ever find anything that's equal? It's changeable, uncertain, impermanent. And these bodies are earth, fire, water, and air. They're compounded, they're made up, they're created, they're born, they grow up, get old, and die. They're food bodies, depending on sustenance for survival. We need air to breathe. We need space to live. But yet, equality is here and now, present, because conscious awareness is not personal. It's not something that I can claim as my personal identity. Consciousness, pure consciousness, is undefined. It's not an object that you can ever realize or see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think. But it's here and now, apparent here and now, timeless. So it's Dhamma. In Dhamma, that's where the differences no longer matter, no longer seem terribly important. At this time in the world, there's so much confusion. You hear about starvation, about pollution, about natural disasters, about injustices, political positions, strong views about right and left, And these are all opinions and views. They're empty phenomena in their reality. And yet, we can fight over nothing, over empty views. The wars that exist at this time are about views, strong identities that separate one group from another group. So right view is not a righteous view. Right view is knowing that all conditions are impermanent, in anicca. Now, this is not a view to grasp, but to explore, to investigate. Is that true? Is everything impermanent? Then you can see, well, Buddha said that everything's impermanent, so then we must never doubt the Buddha. So I believe everything. That's still not getting the point of the Buddha's teaching. The bhavana or the meditation is investigating. Is everything impermanent? What you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think. Can you find anything through witnessing that has any permanent quality to it? And this is investigating feeling, emotion, memory, investigating means to find out for yourself, not just grasping Buddha's teachings that you find in the scriptures or the teachers provide. So this, you know, the alms mendicant is a form to devote yourself to this investigation. Bhavana is investigating reality. It's not about becoming a Buddhist or becoming a bhikkhu or a nun. One can feel very attached to one's tradition, like we identify with the Thai forest tradition, which is a very good tradition from my experience. But also, we can become narrow-minded. The use of Vinaya, guidelines for behavior, speech and behavior, we can grasp it so tightly we aren't aware of time or place. We just have very righteous views of what's right and what's wrong. So this can be observed. This observing isn't judging. It's not about there's right and wrong are not absolutes. Like the whole point of mindfulness is being aware of time and place. What's appropriate to this time and this place? In adapting to a cold climate here in England from a tropical climate in Thailand, no, it's very, when I first arrived in living in London, I was trying desperately to keep to the very strict views that I'd acquired in Thailand about Vinaya, about the rules. Because that's how I was very conditioned to see them in it, that this is the only right way to do it and everything else is wrong. But then when you realize that, then that makes it almost impossible to live in a Northern European climate. If you just stick to three robes, like you can in Thailand. So then I decided that England was the first country in the world to industrialize. The Industrial Revolution began here in the UK. And so for several hundred years, they produced so much, there's a lot of extra stuff around, all these Oxfam shops and Salvation Army and various shops that are all over Britain selling used clothing that people no longer want. So I started thinking, in terms of the spirit of the Vinaya, these are like rag robes. There's so much extra that can we expect the lay people to purchase new clothes for us at Marks and Spencer or Debenhams, or, you know, when there's all these used shops available for that are very cheap and still usable clothing. So that seemed to satisfy my desire to keep within the spirit of the alms, the rag robes, the alms mendicant. But then people didn't want to buy things for us from Oxfam. So we get nice jumpers from Marks and Spencer instead, which is grateful. It's not wrong, but the mindset is to be one who's grateful what's offered rather than have a high standard of what one has to have. That's for people who are not mendicants. Rag robes are... You know, I've never had to go into a charnel ground and take unwrapped corpses to make my robes. Even in Thailand, they were always... When I first met Lung Po Cha, I was wearing a robe that was given to me by my preceptor in Nong Khai. And they didn't have a robe big enough for a Western person. So my robes were too small. And so immediately the monks made me a nice big robe that matched my height. So I was very grateful for that. The shelter for the night. Like soon next year, in 2026, they'll plan to rebuild the Bhikkhu Vihara. So this is all possible through the generosity of lay people. And then we might have strong views of what we want for the Bhikkhu Vihara, but it's better to see it as a shelter for the night rather than what I think I want. But we can be aware of that if we all have tendencies to have views and opinions. But views and opinions are grist for the mill. They're part of the path. It's better to witness views, no matter how clever or righteous they might be, to see them as empty phenomena arising and ceasing, rather than to be caught in complaining and troublemaking around the shelter for the night, the food in the alms bowl, the robes that we wear, or the medicine. So what this does, it leads to contentment. Because you're always getting better than rag robes or just alms food that you don't like. We get a wide choice. We can select the food we put into our alms bowls, things like this. We have nice shelters to live in. We've got the national health, we've got doctors and nurses and therapists and all kinds of experts on mental health and physical health to depend on that are quite willing to offer their services. So here in the UK, experience has been quite surprisingly wonderful for me, because it's better than I ever expected. And I remember when we first moved to Chithurst, a derelict house, and it's actually falling apart. And they had this dry rot in the cellar that creeped up through all the brickwork, stonework, destroying the wood frames. And then there was a movement by some of the local people to get rid of us. So one woman was going around petitioning all the local people around Chithurst to petition us to try to get us to leave because we weren't Christian and the Chithurst house wasn't suitable. And so then I was involved, being president of the English Sangha Trust at the time, and suddenly, you know, I really liked Chithurst, you know, it was a beautiful setting. And I was quite happy to refurbish this derelict building. And everybody seemed, the monks and nuns involved in it were quite eager to help. And so it was, it had a lot of community spirit. Everybody was pitching in to try to make it livable as possible. But every night, the first year, before I went to sleep, I'd say to myself, a shelter for the night. Chithurst House provides a shelter from the rain. And that was great, and I was grateful for that. So even when there was the possibility of having to leave Chithurst, fortunately, the local council was very helpful, sympathized with us. So we were very grateful for that, that the local council in Chichester was supportive when they saw what our intentions were. But still, even in a derelict house, it's a shelter for the night. When we first moved to Amaravati in 1984, we like to remember the cold winter and the frozen pipes and everything. It still had a shelter for the night. You know, that's a way of just being grateful for what we have rather than thinking, you know, I don't like this shelter, I want to go somewhere else. Or if we do think that, we can observe it, that we don't like the shelter we're under is like this. So it's not like I'm advising you to never to complain or grumble about anything, but to use your, these are just human tendencies to complain and grumble, because life, there's so much to complain about in life, in samsara, in the changing realm of samsara. It's so imperfect. And even when you can get it to a level of perfection and excellence, something will happen. That isn't going to benefit us. It's going to cause problems, because the nature of samsara is problematic. It's about problems. It's about division, right and wrong, good and bad. And just contemplate that this is about language. My own insight into Dhamma when I let go of everything was that Dhamma doesn't have a language. Pali, Thai, Sanskrit, English, or whatever language is our sankharas, all words, our perceptions, our sankharas, our empty phenomena. So trying to realize nibbana through the ego, through effort made by the ego, by the grasping of righteous views, is an impossible situation. It's totally impossible to do that. The ego can't ever become enlightened. The ego is a created condition. It's not Dhamma. It's not the Dhamma, the deathless reality, supreme reality that is apparent here and now. The ego is a creation. It's empty. And we can be aware of the ego when we're just blindly fooled, deluded by our own egos, then we are fools. We don't use wisdom to live our life. But when we can see the ego, how did you acquire the sense of being a separate person? You know, when you were a child. Because that's how it looks. You're born, you've got a mother, a father, everything seems separate. And the society tends to see that, the believe in the separateness of conditioned phenomena as their supreme reality. So trying to straighten out samsara as an act of will, of personal ego intention, is, you can make it better, but it's never going to be perfect. It's always subject to change. Things go in cycles. And at my age, you know, you realize in lifetime how things have changed from my culture of conditioning to the present day. Just in 90 years, I've seen an enormous amount of change of cultural views and opinions. So cultural views and opinions, whether they're right or wrong, left or right, are conditioned phenomena. And when we grasp conditioned phenomena, then we suffer. That's the cause of suffering. So it's not that the conditions make us suffer, it's the grasping of them. So I encourage you to realize the freedom we have to be the witness to phenomena rather than the phenomena itself. When we identify ourselves as a phenomenon, then we are subject to all kinds of problems and difficulties, because that's the way it is. But when we see our true nature is the deathless reality of Dhamma, pure conscious awareness, here and now, then we can survive the problems, the vicissitudes of life that we experience through this form. So the alms mendicancy is kind of a miracle to me. How did the Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago in India, how did he expect a monastic order to survive on alms, just on alms? You know, and then Lungpa Cha was always emphasizing, when I doubted about coming to live in England, he simply said, "Are there good people in England?" And I said, "Yes, I'm sure there are." And he said, "Go." So Lungpa Cha had this faith, this kind of wisdom to know that one can survive. You don't need a particular culture that supports Buddhist monks or nuns to survive. That the actual teaching itself, the Four Noble Truths, is a teaching pointing to awakening rather than dogmatic beliefs. So there's nothing to believe in. You're not asked to believe in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or, you know, you might believe in it, but that's still a perception you're grasping. But the whole point of the bhavana is to investigate, see belief as a condition, a grasping of what you hear, see, smell, taste, touch. And that grasping is the cause of suffering. So the winter's retreat begins in a week or so, and this is opportunity in wintertime here in England, here at Amaravati, to have 3 months dedicated to investigating. Let's give a generous period of time to just be encouraged to investigate Dhamma, the reality of here and now, by observing, being the witness to your own body, your emotional habits, your views and opinions. Then this winter's retreat is supported very willingly by lay people that come and take on the duties to help run the monastery, the cooks, the clerks, the secretaries, the members, and people, guests that come and stay and help during winter. There, this is to be seen as a great blessing, because it gives us this rare opportunity as a human individual to spend 3 months dedicated to investigating reality itself, to realize supreme reality for oneself. So I offer this as a reflection.